is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. A South Korean court has dismissed an attempt by NT traditional owners to block funding for a major gas project in the Timor Sea. Now, what does all of this mean for Santos's $4.7 billion Barossa project? We'll be taking a look at this soon. Also today, we speak to the new NT president of the Isolated Children's Parents Association and ask for her thoughts on the Territory's new Education Minister, Eva Lawler. And before 1:30 this afternoon, you will hear from a very, very happy horse breeder who sold a mare yesterday for $4 million.
She's won a couple of Group 2s, a Group 3, and then she's been placing in some Group 1s this year. So she's just a tough, hard-knocking race filly, and she's beautiful. So she was in very high demand here.
Another big country hour. Let's get into it. We are broadcasting right across the Territory on the ABC, and hello there if you are tuning in via the podcast. First up today, I want to take you to the Coastal Plains Research Farm near Darwin to take a look at rice. For decades now, there's been plenty of talk about the potential for a native rice industry in northern Australia. Well, this potential is now getting tested in the paddock, and it's happening near Humpty Doo, which of course has a very interesting history when it comes to rice. Let's get out into the paddock and take a look.
I'm a bag there.
Hi Matt, I'm Penny Vorm from Charles Darwin University in the Research Institute for Environment and Livelihoods.
And today we're out at the Coastal Plains Research Farm near Darwin. In front of us is a bay filled with water. And tell us about what's in it.
We're very excited to be having this actual demonstration planting here in the soil. It's got three species of native rice in it, Matt. So there's Oryza australiensis up close to us. The middle plot is Oryza meridionalis. And the far one is Oryza ruthipogon. So three species of native rice, all from the Northern Territory.
And under this commercial netting, how are they performing?
We're really happy with how easy it was to plant them and to get them to perform. There's some pest problems, but there seems to be lots of seed as well in all of them. They're all responding slightly differently to the two treatments. So we've got flooded and we've got what we're calling aerobic or irrigated but not flooded. Yeah, and so this is really great for us to just get a feel for how they perform in the soil. We've been doing pot trials up to this point. Mm.
And take us back a little bit, Penny. Native rice trials, what's the aim here?
Yeah, so the aim, we're actually working on a project at the moment that's funded by the Future Food Systems CRC, and we have some in-kind support from, support from Department of Industry, Tourism and Trade. Here we are at their field site doing our demonstration planting. We're hoping to develop a high value but low volume enterprise, culturally identified as an additional value for Indigenous enterprises based on a native grain. So it won't replace the rice you can buy in Woolies for $2 a kilo or $3 or whatever it is now. It would be a niche, boutique, high value and culturally identified product.
The opportunity for native rice has been talked about for a long time. How significant is this step to see it growing here at Coastal Plains and in a paddy system?
Yeah, no, that's really, really significant. So there's lots of logistics to work out with harvesting and processing and things like that, but just to get such a really excellent performance in a small planting is really encouraging for us. And it's also been a learning activity. So we're working closely with Nick Hartley, who's a senior technical officer with the Department of Industry, Tourism and Trade, and he's grown lots of Coltigen rice, and he's finding it really interesting to see how differently this rice performs.
As I said, it's under this large netted facility out here at Coastal Plains. I think there'd be a lot of Northern Territory farmers who would love to have this at their place. Is this really the future for native rice, though? If it is to succeed, it needs to be under netting?
We're not sure. We're under netting to avoid, hopefully to manage rodent pests and also magpie geese. Now, at this time of year, there's plenty of rice for magpie geese. They're not going to come and bother a little planting like this.
Yep.
So we're just being overcautious by, doing it in this enclosure. But in the wild, they're a primary food for magpie geese. And you might remember that magpie geese have been blamed for the failure of the collagen rice crops in northern Australia, whether it was just magpie geese or not. But that is something that we'll find out about as well. We have researchers at CDU who've done a lot of work with magpie geese in mangoes, and they've learnt a lot about magpie goose behaviour and how to manage them. So there's potential for us to tackle that problem.
Yes.
You may have heard of those projects. But at the moment we're just being very cautious under this fabulous facility.
It's amazing.
It is amazing. Yeah, and they do.
And these native varieties are tolerant to rice blast, is that right?
Yes, there is rice blast here.
In the north, yep.
Yes. It's when you say tolerant, there is blast, but it's not a devastating impact. Now, it does obviously all, you can see the rice at this stage, so they're all perhaps towards the end of their seeding phase, and love to talk to you a bit more about that too. But you can see the leaves have a lot of different sort of blemishes and blotches and things on the leaves, and also the inflorescences have what we think might be some sort of fungus in the leaves as well, in the inflorescences. So we're going to be collecting some of those today and find out what they are. But it's about a trade-off between the value of the grain and how much you produce. So we're not going, as I say, we're not going for broad acre, replace the shelves in Woolies with this. It's a boutique niche sort of market. So it's just the impact's not devastating. The plants are adapted. They've co-evolved with the pests that are here. Yeah.
If you're tuning in, this is the Country Hour, and we're out at the Coastal Plains Research Farm with Penny Warm from Charles Darwin University, and we're talking about rice. I'll just bring you a bit closer to the bay here. Let's put our hand in it. Listen to that. Water for native Australian rice in the Northern Territory. That water's pretty fresh. I've spent all week, Penny, speaking to mango growers about what sort of weather they need, what sort of overnight temperatures they need. What's the story with rice?
So rice grows, that's a fabulous question. rice grows all across northern Australia. We don't know about the effects of temperature, so that's something that we haven't measured at all. Yeah. We have a PhD student on the project, Jahan Abdulghani, and Jahan's doing some detailed nursery studies looking at things like density, tolerant, what sort of water regimes required, detailed studies that are hard to do in the field and that we're starting to do in the nursery where we can control features. In terms of temperature, we have a very sort of, our temperature is consistently, the maximum temperature is fairly consistent, minimum drops down. Climate change is on the horizon. Temperatures are already increasing here. Don't know what the impact is going to be on that.
The rice harvest is wrapping up in the Riverina down south in Australia. Great paddocks there do about 10 tonne a hectare.
Yes.
What is the potential for native rice in terms of yields?
Yep. So 10 tonnes, that's right, maybe 12 in some areas of the world, up to 12. We won't be getting anything like that with this rice. So I measured in the wild in a fairly monocultural patch of one of the annual arisa, about 300 kilograms per hectare.
Wow.
So that's without any management at all. That's low yields. We're hoping that with this agronomic work, like looking at soil amendments, we're going to do some trials with organic soil management, but we've done some fertiliser trials and it responds really positively to
the
that.
Native rice doesn't
mind. Native rice, yeah, it doesn't mind
like
at all.
Like all plants.
Like all plants. It was almost like gamba grass with some of it. So we've recently just completed a yield study. We haven't got the results yet, unfortunately. We've just got lots of bags of samples waiting to be counted and dried and measured and bulked up. So that in the next couple of months we'll be looking at that and then be able to give you a quote of how many kilograms or tons per hectare with we found with that initial trial. Mm-hmm.
You've been working on this project for so long, Penny. What are your hopes?
Hopes are that we learn more about this fascinating, globally significant native group of species. That's one thing, is just learning more about the plants. We've got other projects planned that will look more at that. There are people also already working on the genetic relationships, so you know that it's an asset that we need to know about. This particular project, what we're hoping is, we'll, at this first stage, is that we produce agronomic knowledge that is going to enable growers who are interested in a boutique, perhaps a diversification option, perhaps a tourism enterprise that wants to produce some native rice as part of a as a sample to sell to their clients. That's what we're actually looking for.
Imagine a restaurant in Darwin who had native Australian rice on the menu.
Yeah, we've trialled it. So we have an industry partner, Puddicle Aboriginal Cultural Tours is one of our industry partners, and we had a Ag Futures grant a few years ago, and we took samples to restaurants, and all the restaurants are dead keen. They don't even mind if this grain's a little bit cracked, so that's one of the processing issues, but they said that's still, and they can add it as a as an amendment to other foods.
They just need supply.
And same with a small packet of grain. The Puddicle Aboriginal Cultural Tours, Graham and Lynette Kenyon, found that tourists were interested in a little packet of grain that people have done a floodplain tour, maybe had some meal with rice in it, and that tourists were happy to pay sort of $10 for a 100-gram pack. Yep. So that's $100 a kilo. So that's the kind of we're thinking. That's our thinking at the moment, yeah.
Lovely to be out here with you today, Penny. Thanks for sharing this with our audience.
Yeah, thanks very much for the opportunity to talk about it, Matt. Thanks very much.
A big thanks to Penny Vaughan from Charles Darwin University in the Research Institute for Environment and Livelihoods, talking about native rice being tested there in the paddock. As I said, it's not just out in the paddock, it's under this huge commercial net. I'd love to know what it cost. It is big, it's impressive. And if you are a Northern Territory farmer listening to the Country Hour this afternoon and interested in putting up some netting over your crops, then make sure you stay tuned, because in the second half of the program, I'll be telling you about a grants program that's just been made available to Territory farmers to help cover the costs of new netting. And we're talking about quite substantial dollars here as well. It's a new grants program. I'll tell you about it in the second half of the show. 18 to 1 on the Country Hour. It's not very often on this program that we talk about the legal system in South Korea. But a South Korean court has made an interesting decision. It's involving a gas project just to our north. I'll run you through the details and the ramifications of it next. That is Way Out West, right across the territory on the ABC. You are tuned into the Country Hour. As always, if you need to duck out into the paddock for whatever reason, you can always download our podcast and listen at a time that suits you. Now, a South Korean court has dismissed an attempt by NT traditional owners to block funding for Santos's $4.7 billion Barossa gas project. A group of Larrakia and Tiwi Islanders went to a South Korean court to try and stop two banks from lending around $1 billion to Santos to help develop its new gas field to the north of Darwin. The Environment Centre NT's Jason Fowler supported the TOs with their court challenge. He told Dan Fitzgerald why the court made its decision.
For three main reasons, the injunction was dismissed. Firstly, the courts decided that even if they did block the funding, Santos and SKNS could go and get funding from elsewhere, so it wouldn't ultimately stop the project from going ahead. But the main reason was that the South Korean courts decided that ultimately this is a decision for the Australian government, and they couldn't really judge on whether the Tiwi Islanders' rights had been materially, you know, affected. Because they, you know, they're not experts on the Aboriginal Land Rights Act or the Native Title Act, like we are here in Australia. So ultimately, they said that it's something for the Australian government to approve or not.
So what happens next in terms of Santos getting that funding?
There'll be several hundred million dollars opening up for them to use to build the project. But I will say that this is Australia's dirtiest gas field, and it certainly should not go ahead. And the Tiwi traditional owners have made it very clear that they don't want a big polluting gas project in their backyard. So they'll certainly be looking at more options.
Santos it's already well underway with construction on the floating offshore vessel that will be used at Barossa. It's submitted an application for a license for a pipeline. Is it too late to stop this project?
No, not at all, Dan. There's got a long way to go. There's another three major approvals to get yet. They have a pipeline approval, yes, but they've just got an approval for a drilling plan, which has a lot of flaws with it. But there's been no pipeline built yet and no drilling has occurred yet. So out in the sea, there's very little happening at all. And they still have to get all their operations approvals. So they've got a long way to go yet.
So will you be launching more legal action to try and stop it?
We'll have to see what the Tiwi traditional owners want to do. I'm certainly under the impression they're furious about this pipeline, and they're furious about the absolute lack of consultation with the Tiwi traditional owners. They really don't understand what a big gas project looks like and what it means for their sea country. So I would expect them to certainly continue on their journey to block this project.
It's looking more likely that Federal Labor could just form a majority government and not need the support of the Teal Independents or the Greens. What do you think that will mean for projects like the Barossa?
Oh, look, the incoming Albanese government have made it very clear that they would support First Nations people in Australia, and this will be their first big test. The Tiwi traditional owners have made it very clear they don't want a big gas project in their backyard, and will the Albanese government stand behind them or not? Or will they? And secondly, this will be a big test for their climate commitments as well. I mean, here you are talking about developing one of the dirtiest gas fields in Australia at almost 20% carbon dioxide. If they expect to meet their climate commitments, there is no way they can do that and keep opening up these really dirty gas fields. So there's two big tests in the pipeline here for the Albanese government.
Labor has already said that it supports the development of gas basins like the Beetaloo. Judging on that, you wouldn't think they'd be stopping things like the Barossa?
Look, they're trying to have their cake and eat it too there, Dan. You can't be opening up really polluting gas projects that run for the next 25 years and expect to lower emissions at the same time. It just doesn't work like that. It's quite clear here. They need to stop dreaming and get on with the job.
That is Jason Fowler from the Environment Centre NT speaking to Dan Fitzgerald, who joins me in the studio this afternoon with some other resources news. Dan, the international owner of a mine here in the Northern Territory, set to pay out a huge settlement and plead guilty to bribery charges. What can you tell us?
I'm talking about Glencore, Matt, which is headquartered in Switzerland and operates the MacArthur River mine out Borroloola way. So it'll pay a settlement of $1 billion US.
Gee.
And plead guilty to 7 counts of bribery in a UK court. This is according to The Guardian. So the UK's Serious Fraud Office alleged that Glencore was responsible for profit-driven bribery and corruption across the company's oil operations in Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, Ivory Coast, Nigeria, and South Sudan. It alleged that Glencore agents and employees paid bribes worth over $25 million US for preferential access to oil with approval by the company. So some pretty serious stuff there.
I reckon.
Glencore said in a statement, Glencore today is not the company that it was when the unacceptable practices behind this misconduct occurred.
It's a big story.
Yeah, $1 billion. So $700 million to resolve some US bribery and investigations, and then almost $500 million to resolve some market manipulation investigations.
Thanks for the update, Dan.
Yo, my name's David Mariela Yunapingu. I work at the Ranger and culture advisor, taking all the kids, learning on country, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Did you see Alan Kohler on ABC News last night? He said the big commodity story of the year is food. And he is bang on. With the audience last night, he shared a graph from the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization. It showed the global food price index, which has hit a record high. It's up 75% over the last 2 years. Switch on the news and it's all there in front of you, isn't it? The world's food supply is running short. Major grain exporting nations are at war. And according to one analyst, he believes governments will fall before the situation gets better. Brett Stewart is the president of Global AgriTrends, a firm that consults with food companies and reports on market movements. He spoke to the Country Hour's Warwick Long.
We're watching that very closely, you know, and it all started, Warwick, with COVID. And not just COVID, but the trillions of dollars that was poured in stimulus around the world. In the U.S. alone, we increased the U.S. money supply 40% in 2 years. And that was over $6 trillion stimulus. And so the big wave of inflation around the world really began with COVID. Consumers began buying, spending money, overloaded demand, overloaded supply chains. Sick workers slowed down production, slowed down logistics. Then we fast forward into 2022 and we see the Russian invasion of the Ukraine, potentially jeopardizing 1/4 of the global wheat export. The Ukraine is the number 4 corn exporter in the world. And the commodity markets just continue to rise on concerns of potential scarcity. And so around the world, we're already seeing signs of impending social instability. We expect to see governments turn over before this is done. Particularly, the risk lies in the Middle East, North Africa, Central Africa. Those nations that are heavily dependent on imported food face some serious problems now.
You quite literally expect governments to change over the fact that there isn't a lot of available food in the marketplace.
Yeah, and we're actually seeing some of these countries take some strict policy action. India had talked about banning their wheat exports. Just this week, both Brazil and Mexico lifted import tariffs on a whole raft of food items. You can see the nervousness out there in the market, and it is it's quite unsettling.
How long does this go on for? Does it last as long as the war in Ukraine lasts, or is that too simplistic?
Well, that's a good question, you know, and the world crop supply runs on a crop year. If we have these high prices, the expectation is we will produce more next year. The problem is, Warwick, is we not only have a shortage of crops, we potentially have shortages of fertilizer, which are the key input to creating more crops. With the La Nina pattern still intact in the Pacific, there's still risk of drought concerns into mid-year in North America with the grain supply, as well as South America.
What are you watching then? What are the factors at play that you are keeping an eye on?
Well, we're just watching very closely the global food indices to see where those prices move. We're watching very closely to see policy actions around the world that can further disrupt food supplies and trade. You know, it's not just the grain market. We're in a unique spot here, Warwick, where even in the protein space, we're coming into 2022 with fewer global cows in the world than we had a year ago. We have a smaller cow herd. We have a smaller swine herd than we had a year ago. And it's good news for producers because they have a chance here at keeping pace with inflation.
Why is that? Why do we have a smaller cow and swine herd?
It's complicated. Now, one of the major factors, especially for South America, has been Chinese demand. Strong Chinese demand has led to record prices across South America, which has prompted them to slaughter their females more aggressively. And so they're now into a situation where they have shrunk their breeding herd as they slaughter aggressively for China.
Can you go through what the U.S. situation looks like?
Yeah, sure. We've still got significant drought across the Midwest, especially the western half of the country. Hay prices are very short and very tight. And so, again, input costs are high. Producers would like to expand, but when there's no forage or feed, there is simply no option to expand. And so we expect that we'll see this U.S. cow herd down potentially 4% this year in the next inventory report in July. That decline in U.S. beef production for 2023 is the largest decline in 44 years out of America. One thing I didn't mention, we talked about the global food indices, Warwick, is global beef prices are at all-time record highs, and every month they keep going higher. So we're in a spot where the world is short on beef. Prices are absolutely fantastic. Every nation on earth is in decline except Australia, which is the lone country in a rebuild situation. And so it really is a fantastic outlook for Australia.
That is Brett Stewart, president of Global AgriTrends, speaking there to Warwick Long. He's right that Australian farmers and cattle producers are enjoying extremely high prices for their product. But what's probably taking the cream off all of that is the fact that all of the imports are also at record highs. Hearing from a lot of farmers here in the Northern Territory, the fuel bill, the fertiliser bill, all that is really adding up. And so, yes, the commodity prices are high, but so is everything else.
Yo, what's going on, everybody? My name is Gilambanu, aka Bolabaro, Narayako, Rilipirbanu, yo.
Yo, my name is Davis Wirupanda, and I'm from Baniala. I work at Kulukula. My Yolngu name is Wadon. I'm a Yolngu man.
And you're listening to Country Hour.
Matt Brand with you this afternoon. I can tell you that some commercial mud crabbers in the Northern Territory have had a run-in with the law. Details on the Country Hour in just a moment. And you'll also hear from a very, very happy horse breeder who sold a mare yesterday for $4 million.
She's won a couple of Group 2s, a Group 3, and then she's been placing in some Group 1s this year. So she's just a tough, hard-knocking race filly, and she's beautiful. So she was in very high demand here.
$4 million for a horse. That's the sort of world we live in. Oh, and if you have been thinking about investing in netting to protect your crops, keep the birds away, then don't go anywhere. Got some information coming your way in just a moment about how you can get some funding to help with that investment. First up, let's go to the Weather Bureau. Moses Rako is there this afternoon. How are you, Moses?
I'm going well, thank you, Matt.
It's the way. Now, you were on ABC Radio earlier today and made some comments about Central Australia and some potential moisture next week, and it's got people excited. Just remind us, what's the forecast?
Well, yeah, just based on our guidance, which as you know can change significantly, but most of the guidance is indicating that we may see another cloud band develop over Western Australia and kind of pushing into parts of the southern parts of the NT initially, and that's probably going to be from the start of next week. There's going to be a trough associated with that, we expect, and behind that trough with another high we might see, and of course that cloud cover as well, we could see some temperatures dropping a little bit more into next week, a more significant change, and potentially some rainfall with that cloud band as well. So still waiting for those guidance to consolidate a bit further, but just something we'll be keeping an eye on, and it's kind of indicating that some cooler temperatures, some wet weather potentially on the cards for southern, initially for southern parts, and see how we go, could extend into parts of the central districts as well for the middle of next week. But that's what we're watching, yeah.
And I understand potential is the key word here, but also potential flooding, is that right?
That all depends on the amount of course, rainfall that it comes with that. Like I said, it's just early stages where the kind of the models are kind of coming together a little bit better. Rainfall amounts, it really kind of at this stage, a bit hard to get an exact amount of that, but flooding at this stage is a possibility. You can't completely rule it out, but yeah, it's just something we'll probably need to keep a close eye on over the coming day or two.
Right. More will be known what come Monday, Tuesday next week?
Definitely by then we would definitely know, yes.
Yep. in the top end? What do the next few days look like?
Yeah, next few days. So basically, we've basically have the situation where we're getting those sea breezes coming in during the afternoon and evening, returning that moisture. We do have a weak surge, probably extending across a good portion of the top end from Friday, maybe into Saturday. So that will see, of course, those winds freshening a little of parts of our coastal waters, and mainly in the Roper Group coast, those winds picking up. It may also just lead a slightly drier trend as well over parts of the top end. So just slightly drier conditions potentially, but it's only a weak one, so we're not seeing really strong gusty winds kind of extending across our coastal walls. Not expecting coastal wind warnings and the like, just maybe potentially just slightly drier from Friday and Saturday. And then after that, we might see the moisture pick up a little as we head into next week. So not a significant change, but just some subtle changes for the top end.
Because I see Goombalunya is expecting a top of 36 degrees today. You know, it's almost June and Goombalunya hitting 36.
It is.
And that's a bit much.
It is. And looking at the temperatures that we've got for the 1st of June, it's a long way out. We're still seeing some temperatures around the top end into the mid-30s. So it's remaining above average at this stage. Unfortunately, seeing those temperatures, warmer temperatures, extending into the beginning of June potentially.
Okay. I got a text here from Alex. Says, Matt, in light of forecasts for rain in the southern NT early next week, I think we ought to be alert for the possibility of floods. I understand there's a major cold weather system coming in from the south, together with moisture feeding in from the northwest. Given the frequency of extreme weather events these days, says Alex, maybe we need to be prepared for disruption to transport in a still soggy outback South Australia, reckons Alex.
Yes, that's it does look like that. It basically, you've summed it up perfectly. Yeah, we've got another cloud band situation developing. So, like I said, we'll be keeping a close eye on that as it plays out, and of course the rainfall amounts that we kind of may expect.
Maybe we should try and get that the company on that looks after the rail corridor, because obviously such huge damage at the start of this year. I'm losing track of time. It was the start of this year, wasn't it, where a bunch of the rail got blown out.
Yep.
Such a rush to get it fixed and back in action. I just wonder in the repairs, if anything was done to try and prevent future damage, or they just went and built the same thing again.
I'm
just thinking out loud, Moses. Yeah. I'm not expecting you to answer that, but maybe we should get that company on. Yeah. All right, then. You have a lovely, lovely afternoon.
Thanks, Matt.
Tales from the tinny.
Threw the cast net out to get bait, got stuck in a rock. So what did I do?
You jumped in.
Thank you. You can't let a good net go to waste. So again, there's a question of safety versus catching the big one. Do you know what I mean? Is that dedication or stupidity? I don't know.
Look at it. There's a fine balance there. I'm not sure which side of the ledger you actually fall on, but I've got my suspicions.
Subscribe to the podcast or reel it in anytime you like on the ABC Listen app.
It is 12 past one. You are tuned into the Country Hour. Would you like some money? Then tune into this, a federal government program to help farmers with the costs of horticultural netting has just been extended to the Northern Territory. Joining me again in the studio is Dan Fitzgerald. Dan, how do our farmers get hold of cash?
Matt, if farmers want to put some horticultural netting up over their crops, they can. If they're spending up to $100,000 on installing new netting over crops or repairing some old netting, they'll be eligible for a grant to cover up to 50% of those costs. So there's nearly a total of $365,000 available to commercial growers in the Northern Territory. I'm told there's one grower, mango grower, who's already expressed some interest, and that's pretty much why this grant has been extended to the Territory.
Right.
So they want to have a go at putting nets over top of mangoes.
And for example, if that project cost $100,000, I don't really know how much this stuff can cost, but if it was set to cost $100,000, it would now cost, he'd have to fork out $50,000, government stumps up the rest.
Yeah, that's right, a grant. Ooh. For the rest, for 50% of those costs. Mm-hmm. Mohammed Sahel Mazza, he's the horticulture group leader with the Department of Industry here in the Territory. He says that netting, it could provide some benefits for a whole range of Territory crops.
all of the horticulture crops are suitable for netting. The main purpose is protection from pests and protection from extreme weather conditions. So both of them, they are our major concerns. Extreme weather conditions, they impact nearly all of the crops, and pests, they mainly damage our fruit crops. So everything from mango, jackfruit, rambutan, dragon fruit, and vegetables, they are all. And if we go to the central region, we have grapes, and at trial level, we have almond, jujube, and in some areas, we have dates. So all of these, they can benefit from this opportunity.
Would it really work out to be profitable to put netting over mangoes?
Look, this is, this is primarily derived from one of our growers in the top end. So the grower himself, they were interested in establishing netting on part of their farm, thinking that it will be a trial to see that how it impact the produce quality and the water management. And this grant will be supporting their trial at first instance. And of course, this is only one of other crops which I listed before. And the other farmers, they can directly benefit from it. And mango for mango farmers, it will be one of the options which will be trialed in the first year.
Mohammed Sahel Mazza, he's the horticultural group leader with the Department of Industry. And for the growers out there who are interested in this program, you can apply from today. A pretty easy way to find it is just to search for horticultural netting program on your internet, and you'll find a website through there.
If you want to grow native rice commercially and get some cheap netting, away you go.
There you go.
And when people in years to come say, how did this all come about? They can say, oh, I'll just into the Country Hour one day. Some news out in the water, Dan.
Yeah, Matt. Just got a little note here from NT Water Police. They've been out on some of the more remote parts of the territory doing some checks on recreational commercial vessels. So earlier this month, they were out in the Roper and Limon Bight areas. According to a statement here from Sergeant Troy Harris, who says, with the assistance of some Limon Sea Rangers, we seized 18 abandoned commercial mud crab pots and issued 2 fisheries infringement notices for abandoned gear. We also issued 2 commercial mud crabbers with improvement notices, which were rectified within 24 hours. It goes on to say there were also a further 2 recreational vessels in the area who were non-compliant, and those issued those skippers with infringement notices. So, yeah, NT Water Police, been busy out on the Roper and Limon.
An improvement notice.
Just exactly what that is, I'm not entirely clear, but just a clean up your act sort of thing by the sounds of it.
And they rectified it within 24 hours, as you do. Thanks, Dan.
Dad, we're back!
They're your favourite healers. And you said you wanted more?
Definitely.
Well, we've got more.
But you have to promise not to do any more disgusting things.
What?
More mischief.
Make up your mind.
More games.
What does this button do?
And maybe just a few more disgusting things.
Dad! What? This is outrageous.
Brand new Bluey.
Yes!
Stream from Monday, June 13 on ABC iView.
Bluey!
17 past one. As you know, the Northern Territory's got a new Education Minister, Eva Lawler. This is part of the Cabinet reshuffle that we saw earlier in the week. How is this being seen by families below the Barama line? Kids at school of the year, what do they make of our new Education Minister? It's a question Max Rowley put to the President of the NT Isolated Children's and Parents Association, Moira Lanzarin.
Eva Lawler's been Education Minister before, and so she's already familiar with ICPA. And to be honest, a lot of our issues haven't changed since her time. But we will need to reintroduce ourselves and put the issues back on the table and back in front of her. But I'm sure it'll be a smooth transition.
And federally, there's been a change of government as well. We don't yet know who the education minister will be on a federal level. Does this change of government change the priorities at all, or the focus for the ICPA?
No, I don't think it changes the priorities at all. Going into bat for the best outcomes for our geographically isolated children is always the focus, and we're apolitical, and so we work well with whoever's in government at the time and across all parties. And so it does mean that we will have to bring new ministers and senators up to speed, but I'm sure it's not going to be any issues whatsoever.
What are the first things that you'd like these ministers to know?
Yep. Look, in the territory, our five top issues really haven't changed for quite some time. At a territory level, the anti-student assistance scheme for geographically isolated students, and particular accessing like boarding allowances, that's been a big one. The thanks to delegation and regular work in interactions with the department, we believe that we're making progress there. Number two, the mobile playgroups and keeping them there and getting them there for the likes of the Centralian families who haven't had a mobile playgroup service like we're so fortunate enough to have in the Katherine region, like Kix and Smile a Mile in the top end. The third one is that early diagnosis of health issues and learning needs. The diagnosis and treatment and access for those allied health services is really important. Number four, communications. Without reliable communications, your base options aren't available for school of air and distance, any of the forms of distance ed or learning in general, and just having families out bush. And then five, which is one that crosses both territory and federally, and that's our push for distance education home tutor allowance. At the moment, it's compulsory to have a home tutor in the classroom for our public education for our bush kids, but that's a cost 100% borne by the families.
And the dust is still settling on the election, but did the campaign itself and what was being offered from either of the parties, did that bring you a bit of hope of addressing some of these key priorities for the ICPA?
Look, yes. Keeping abreast of it all as an individual or even as an organisation is difficult. We all wear our ICPA hats as volunteers, 100% volunteers, and we still have the rest of our lives and businesses and children's education and families to also look after. Federal Council have done a wonderful job on looking after their federal policies and keeping the ministers on their toes of both parties, and so we're very fortunate for that and the whole network and working together.
Moira Lanzarin, who is the new NT president of the Isolated Children's Parents Association, speaking to Max Rowley. Eva Lawler, the Territory's new education minister, also the new treasurer. And as we've mentioned on the program, the Northern Territory has a new agribusiness and fisheries minister in Paul Kirby. He will be joining us live tomorrow at 12:30 on the Country Hour. Looking forward to that. 22 past one. Up next, you'll meet the breeder who sold that mare yesterday for $4 million.
Whiskey for my man, beer for my horses. Singing whiskey.
You could buy a few beers for this. $4 million for one thoroughbred mare. That's what was forked out at the Magic Million sale yesterday. The horse's name? Away Game. And it becomes the second highest price broodmare or filly sold at that Gold Coast sale. It was bred by Hannah Jennings of Kalora Stud, who was there to see the hammer fall.
It's pretty incredible. It's so surreal. I mean, like, we hoped she'd sell well, but to sell for $4 million was beyond all expectations.
Yeah, tell me about Away Game. Tell me a little bit about her and what makes her worth $4 million.
Yeah, so she's by a Schnitzel, who's one of the leading stallions in Australia. And she won the Magic Millions two-year-old classic, and then she went on to get second in the Golden Slipper Group 1 race. And she's won a couple of Group 2s, a Group 3, and then she's been placing in some Group 1s this year. So she's just a tough, hard-knocking race filly. and she's beautiful. So she was in very high demand here.
So it sounds like that money, while you thought she'd bring a good price, it has exceeded your expectations.
Right, absolutely. Now, we thought she'd bring good money, but you just never know until they're there in the ring.
What will the future look like for Away Game? Where is she headed to now?
So she's going to go to Yulong, a stud farm in Victoria, and she'll be bred. She'll probably run a couple more times, including this Saturday in the Kingsford Smith, and then she'll be bred probably in, I'd say, September-ish.
Okay, and so her life then will really be as a brood mare from then on.
Yes, exactly. She'll live the good life out in the fields, and yeah, she'll have a really happy life.
Is Away Game one of the highest priced horses you've seen? Tell me a bit about your horses and what you've sold over the years. Is Away Game up there in the top for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we sold a stallion prospect a couple years ago named Nadal to Japan. He went for great money, but as far as fillies go, I mean, $4 million is really the top of what you could imagine.
Well, tell me, what are you seeing there at the sale in terms of the money and the trends you're seeing for fillies and brood mares?
Yeah, I mean, they're all selling strong. The market's just been so strong here in Australia across the board, from weanlings to yearlings to mares. So especially if you have a race filly with good form that could race on a bit more, they're willing to put up the money for those.
And so for you, to sell a horse to that sort of level, that sort of money, what does that mean for you and your own business going forward?
Yeah, so we have a farm in Paris, Kentucky. So we breed horses that we end up going on to race and we sell some. So with that, we'll be able to buy a lot more mares, a lot more foals, and hopefully get some more good race horses out of it.
And what does it mean for your reputation as well as you build yourself in the industry?
It's amazing. I mean, just to be associated with a horse of this caliber is something you can only dream of. So feel really blessed and lucky to be a part of her journey.
That is Hannah Jennings, who had a good day yesterday at the Magic Millions. That mare Away Game selling for $4 million. It's time now in the Country Hour to head to the sale yards. With all the latest prices out of Dublin, here's Peter Kerr.
Good afternoon. At the cattle sale, agent showed 136 head of cattle. These sold to a regular field of buyers, including the trade, feeders and restockers. Quality was very mixed. Yearling steers ranged from 436 to 578 cents, with similar heifers to from 460 to 580 cents, with both feed tracking trade support. Breeders sought steers from 520 to 586 cents and heifers from 440 to 580. Steers to restockers ranged from 410 to 606 cents and heifers from 392 to 450 cents, with those also going to restockers. The grown cattle market was very small. Grown heifers ranged from 362 to 420 cents, with cows from 266 to 300 cents a kilogram. This has been Peter Kerr for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Peter. In the live export trade, feeder steers to Indonesia getting around $4.75 a kilo, according to the LEPI. Just looking at the calendar for the Darwin port, a bit quiet on the live export front. One ship due out this Saturday, if all goes to plan. Another one coming in on Tuesday. But apart from that, not too much to talk about. A little bit quiet for this time of the year. Supply. It is tight. That's it for today's Country Hour. Keep it rural.